Tonight on Arena, Frank McGuinness on the Abbey's new online project, and we review Annie Ernaux's coming-of-age tale, A Girl's Story. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. We were talking last week with Helen Meaney about the theatre work now available to view online. And last night, Miriam McGill reviewed Phoebe Waller-Bridge's stage version of Fleabag. Well, today, the Abbey Theatre announced its latest and newly commissioned digital offering, which has the title Dear Ireland. The Abbey has commissioned 50 writers to each write an individual piece for just one performer. The 50 pieces will go online at the end of the month. One of those writers is Frank McGuinness, and he joins me on the line now. Frank, what exactly was the brief given to you by Abbey directors Graham McLaren and Neil Murray?
Well, it was basically just to write a piece for a single voice of your own choice, that piece would be between 5 and 10 minutes. You choose whatever actor you want to perform it. You chose your subject matter. It was an open book, if you like. And so I found it an irresistible invitation, and I also found it a rather wonderful way of trying to provide a bit of work for a profession that is looking penury in the face for quite a while, I would think, actually. So that's why I was delighted to take part in it.
And that overall title of Dear Ireland suggests almost an address to the nation. Was that in your mind when you sat down to write the piece then?
No, actually, I was more conscious of it being for one person's voice. I was more conscious that you would be trying to get a certain element of grief into it and a certain element of joy. I wanted it to be more than simply a dirge or a mournful note. And I also wanted very much to work again with Joan Sheehy, whom I've worked as an actor and I've worked with as a director, and who's a great friend, and I love her voice. So it was very much a celebration of that voice, and I wanted that note of celebration to come through, that note of we have come through this together.
And was it a piece then, the piece that you wrote is called Pints of Milk, was it something that was already in gestation, or did you literally sit down in front of the blank page and start with Joan's voice in your mind and off you went?
Blank page, Sean. I actually stood in front of the blank page or sat in front of it and let whatever comes, comes. I knew that it was going to have to be strictly written. I knew it was going to have to be tight because of the time span, and you know that was the brief that we were given, and rightly given, so we could not be indulgent. And I wanted to concentrate, if you like, on a single story that might do justice to the form.
Who then is the character that Joan is voicing in the piece?
Well, it's a work of fiction, actually, and she is a woman who is remembering an incident from her childhood, from a very hard childhood. And it would be a typical childhood that many of us had who grew up in Ireland in the 40s and 50s and 60s, when things were tight, money was scarce, we all had to face major disadvantages, we all had to face major challenges, and we tried to do so by sticking together as a family and by sticking together as a tribe and as a society. And that's really where it came from. And as I say, I really did just try to discipline myself to stick to the task in hand and tell this specific story.
Let's listen to a clip then from Pints of Milk, and narrator, as we said, played by Joan Sheehy. And here she is recalling the hardship of her childhood.
Without. That's how this country operated. Doing without. Managing without. Coping without. Everybody in want, or near it. Want that kept us in terror. Living in panic, the next wage would be our last pay. Our mothers might soap us head to toe. The smell of life, boy, the sting in your eyes, shining like new pins. Have pride in yourself, certainly. But those above us, they could do what they wanted to our like.
And that's Joan Sheehy there performing from Pints of Milk, one of 50 commissioned pieces that the Abbey will be putting up on their website towards the end of the month. 50 pieces from 50 writers, each of them for one voice. And the piece that we've just been listening to, written by Frank McGuinness, who's speaking with me this evening. Just that line within that section that we heard, Frank, living in terror, living in panic, the next wage might be our last pay. Practically, it really does mirror where we're at right now, doesn't it, in many ways?
Well, for so many people, that is a reality, and a very harsh and hard reality it is. And indeed, it was a reality that I grew up with in Donegal as a boy and well into my teens. You know, that there was a very strong sense that financially things could go very wrong, not just in the wider society, but also in the immediate society of my own family. So I completely sympathise with the struggle, the enormous struggle people are facing at the minute, and especially people in the acting profession and the whole theatre profession, front of stage, backstage. We really have never faced anything like this before, and I don't know what's going to be the consequence of it. So I wanted to add my voice to the struggle that they're enduring. I know that, it's not entirely a bleak piece. It's not entirely a humorless piece. And, you know, one thing I'll always say about theatre people is that they have that anarchic sense of humour, which has been the survival technique for so long and has been the saving of so many of us. And that's what we share together. So I hope that's in the piece as well. I'm no better woman than Joan for getting that spirit of fun. But we're up against the wall. We are, really. And now it's a question of knocking it down.
And for you as a writer, I mean, obviously, I can't imagine that this is going to be a huge financial stipend for anybody involved. There are 50 writers and 50 performers involved, after all. But I guess, was it as important to actually have a commission, to have something to write towards, as it was to have something that's bringing in a few bob as well?
Well, I think what I would say about this is that the Abbey are doing their job. That's what I have to say. Whatever battles there have been with Graham and Neil been there, and there have been many, and some of them have been justified, they are now doing their job in commissioning this work and in paying these actors, paying our writers. It may not be enough to the flight to Las Vegas, but it is going to put pay a few bob of rent for people, and it's going to put food on the table for some. And that's what they should be doing at the minute, actually, and they should be spreading the bounty as far as possible and as wide as possible and as deeply as possible. So I'm delighted that they're doing it. Also, I feel that I'm very intrigued with what people are going to come up with. How are we all going to react to this? And not one of us is going to be the solitary voice in this. We are doing this collectively. We're doing it together. And that's the only way we're going to beat this thing, is working together.
I mean, it also in some ways brought me back to one of your earliest plays. In fact, I think your very first full-length play, Factory Girls, a female workforce at the heart of that, and they go on strike in a shirt factory looking for their rights in that situation as well. Again, echoes of that situation in where we're at today.
Well, I never lost sight of what made me, and that was a struggle for financial survival. I struggled for work. My mother, my father, and all my aunts, my grandparents, everybody had to work like that to put the button to their mouth, the bite into their mouth, and to put food on the table. And that has marked me for life. That has shaped me for life. And if you like, when in the face of a crisis like this, and being up, like you say, against the wall, where do you go to? You go back to your own, and you listen to the voices that shaped you, and you listen to the strength of them, and you listen to the courage that got them through. And that's what I hope will be our mark this time as a country, of courage and strength, and an infinite capacity to survive will be what saves us.
The other thing, another quote that struck me within that piece that we heard Joan performing, Joan Sheehy performing, was she's talking about those above us. They could do what they wanted to our like. Do you have any sense that the world has changed? Do we live in a fairer world now?
I think that the world has changed to the extent that we now know exactly who the enemy is, and we now know what they're doing. And we also know those who will exploit in the same way as they did, and those who will exploit us, sometimes under the guise of being socialists or left-wing or of a particular party, that are hell-bent on achieving the domination of the country. We have to be very careful with them as well and fight solidly against them.
And coming back to that idea of the blank page in front of you, and I phrased a question earlier on about this idea that to what extent was, in fact, having a commission, having something very specific to write to, how important is that for you at this time? A lot of people presume, oh, sure, we've loads of time in our hands now. It's going to be easy to sit down and do the writing or be creative in some way or shape or form.
Well, put it the case, when I got an email from Louise Stevenson, my friend in the Abbey, who's the literary manager, asking me would I do this, I replied to her within 10 seconds saying yes. In fact, saying yes 5 times. That's how long it took me to decide that I want to be part of this. And I think that I'm delighted to say they're doing it, and I'm proud to be on it.
The other thing that struck me, Frank, in recent times you've written quite a lot of short stories. Now, admittedly, a lot of those short stories are first-person narrations, which has a touch of the monologue about it. But when you were writing this, very specifically a piece that you knew was going to be performed to camera, that because that's the way it's done, is performed to camera by Joan Sheehy, did it change the way you wrote?
Not particularly, actually, but I did know that, I mean, it was going to have to be filmed by Joan, or you know, that she would have to do that. There was no room for the Spielbergs. There was no room for the Cecil B. DeMille effects, although I'm sure Joan, if called upon, could provide them herself. But I just kept it as simple as possible and really tried to celebrate the beauty of her voice and the diversity of her voice, and to do that through the story, to make it as, if you like, far-reaching and as demanding as possible for an actor to perform. And that's really all that guided me when I was doing it. And also I wanted it to pack a hell of a punch, to pack as much of a punch as possible, both a political, emotional and spiritual punch. So it was a tall order to put down on paper in the time that I was giving myself to do it. But I had set myself the task and I was going to do it, come hell or high water. And as I say, the very speed with which I agreed to do this shocked me. And that kind of shock was carried through in the writing of it, that I had to get this done.
But it must have pleased you that you could get it done at that speed as well.
No, it never pleases me, Sean. You know I'm a contrary git.
Should have known better. Finally, what about getting through this whole situation yourself, Frank? I know that you've had some health problems in the recent past. Has that affected how you've had to isolate and work in the last period?
Yes, we are very much isolated. Philip had heart surgery. My partner had heart surgery a couple of years ago. He's had to be very careful. He's down in Dublin now. I have to thank our magnificent neighbours, Kiefer and Damien next door, who couldn't have been kinder, and our friends, Liz Nugent, Kevin Doherty, and so many people. I'm sorry if I can't mention them all, but without them, I don't know what we would have done, because we don't have a car. And, you know, it's really tough getting stuff together without having that car. And the delivery service has been terrific from, you know, various places. Super Value and Avoca have been brilliant. And I'm very grateful to them. As I say, I don't know what we would have done with our neighbours. And they are friends. They're just the best. And I thank them.
Well, it is what you've said in the midst of that interview, I think, is very true, Frank. And more at this time, more than any other, we really need to be together, even though we're physically apart.
Well, all we have is each other, Sean. That's it. You know, never has it been proved more strenuously than now.
All right, Frank. Thanks for speaking to us this evening. That's Frank McGuinness there, speaking to us about his piece Pints of Milk, which is part of Dear Ireland, the new Abbey project, which will premiere online later this month. It'll be released over 4 days. The monologues will be screened in 4 parts at 7:30 from Tuesday the 28th of April to Friday the 1st of May. And that will be on the Abbey's YouTube channel. And we'll get full details of that towards the end of the month. But you can follow updates on abbeytheatre.ie /what's-on/dear-Ireland. And just gone 18 minutes past 7 on Wednesday night's Arena. At almost 80 years of age, Annie Ernaux is a best-selling award-winning French author who has been writing for over half of her life. It's really only in the last decade that she found acclaim in the English-speaking world as her work has been more widely translated. A Girl's Story is her latest memoir, a coming-of-age tale that pivots on the summer of 1958 when she turns 18, has a first taste of freedom working away from home as a counsellor at a summer camp. Sinead Gleeson has been reading Annie Ernaux's A Girl's Story for us, and she joins me now on the line. Annie Ernaux's early work, Sinead, is mostly fiction, but her later books delve into the areas of autofiction and into the area of memoir, and it would seem that they're the ones she'll be remembered for. How would you describe what she's doing in this book, A Girl's Story?
Well, I think you're right, Sean. She when she first started to publish, her very early work was fiction, and I think it was quite a brave move for her to decide, because fiction is the thing that, you know, there are more prizes, there are more ways to get recognition for novels, that she decided that it wasn't for her and moved towards nonfiction. So she's been doing this for a very long time, and she has a very specific kind of style, something that I think a lot of people may have heard this term auto theory, or auto fiction, where people like Rachel Cusk, Maggie Nelson, to a certain extent, write in this way, where it is basically writing heavily autobiographically from your life, but not in a strictly linear, straightforward memoir way. Often it's messing around with voice and persona. And in this particular book, very clearly this is based on Ernaux's life, but at no point does she use the word I about herself. She refers to she or the girl or the London girl when she spends time in London as an au pair. So part of it is about, it's a different kind of subjectivity in writing about the self. So it is a type of nonfiction, but it's a very hybrid kind of form. And it allows her to write not just about herself, but different subjects. So when people hear about Ernaux's work, and there's another excellent book called Happening, which is about it trying to obtain an illegal abortion in France in the 60s, they might think that that sounds very specific to her or just about her life. But what she does, and what all good nonfiction writers do, is that they look inwards and outwards. So what she does is she's looking at the social and political aspects of French life, what it's like to be a woman, desire, politics, coming of age in this particular book. So what she's always telling what seems like quite a personal story in all her work. She's written about her mother and her father. She's always looking outwards at broader society and more global issues.
Well, we might think, she's French. She's a young French woman, albeit 1958. She's a young French woman of 18 years of age at that point in time. How conservative a society was she living in, and is she telling us about in the France of 1958?
Yeah, she is. I mean, she grew up quite working class, and I think she always felt, whenever she was around people who were educated, because she's always been incredibly smart and bright and has taught literature and has been a writer for a lot of her life, she goes to work in a summer camp and she's trying to fit in. She's trying to have this adventure. And the first page of the book says all the girls are wondering, is this the summer they're going to sleep with someone for the first time? So she's starting to reawaken on lots of levels, and is cleverer than a lot of the men, young men around her, but then realises that they're not interested in her cleverness. They're interested in her body. And this is where this kind of, she has this particular encounter this summer with a man she calls H. And what she's doing is, structurally in this book, she's giving us the kind of, bringing us back to 1958 while reporting the story from the 2000s when she was writing it originally. And what that does is not just give her the remove and the distance, but it also gives her a writer's eye view to kind of understand what has happened. Because she says at one point, she only spent two nights with them, and she said the impact that they've had on my life have been immense. And it's just that kind of person that you never quite forget, even though they might have treated you badly, as this man did. He's had a huge impact on her life, and she said, but I know that I've never been a part of his. So it's quite pensive at times, and it's quite beautiful and quite sad that she's almost ashamed in a way of letting this man have such an impact on her, but she has never forgotten. She goes looking for him later on in life on Google, and I don't want to say anything else about what she finds, but it is really that kind of, those just goes to show how indelible those years are, those coming of age years. They linger on for decades.
I was wondering what happened to the man and where he was and what he was doing. Now I'll have to go and find out for myself. She speaks about this going to the summer camp in Normandy, meeting this guy, as you've mentioned, a couple of one-night stands, but she never forgets him. You mentioned this idea that she never uses the first person. It's always she or the girl. How much shame is involved here? How much desire is involved here? And how are the two related?
Yeah, I think they're two very central themes, actually. At one point, she allows herself to buy this fancy red toothpaste, and she writes the words "Long live whores" on the bathroom mirror, much to the consternation of her flatmate. And she's because she's been told that that's what women who sleep with men and maybe sleep with more than one man in a summer are. There's a judgment between what the young men at the camp get up to and what the young women. And she learns very early that while she's full of the same kind of desire as them, there's a different kind of attitude to her behaviour. So she's mocked and ridiculed, and kind of people laugh and scoff about her. And it is that double standard, you know, the stud versus slut double standard, which happens to her. And she says later on that, you know, I realised that shame was a big thing, but that I learned to kind of go without the shame. And later on, she connects this again to she reads The Second Sex by Simone de Beauvoir and says that, you know, the question of how girls were meant to conduct themselves is a big thing. And she says, I used to think it was like, you know, in a very sort of proper manner. When she reads de Beauvoir, who asks a very similar question, her answer is they should conduct themselves with freedom. So she's learning all the time, and books are a huge thing for her. And again, the book is also littered with lots of references to film. She goes to see a lot of goes to the cinema a lot. She reads a lot of books. And again, so it's a sort of like what informs a person, what makes a life, and what makes her make the decisions that she actually does. And she says she often talks a lot about writing in the book. She says at one point, every moment lived without a writing project resembles the last. And she's been a huge diarist all through her life, and obviously has drawn on some of that work. But then I think we have to be careful not to make the kind of relationship between writing diaries and writing nonfiction, because they're two very different things. And there's a lot of craft and omission and excision involved in writing good nonfiction. But it sounds like a very simple and familiar story, the lost love of a youth that you can't forget. But she's also writing about herself. It's not just about the young man. And she says, even when she was working on different books over the decades, she used to write the words 58, meaning 1958. And she said, I always was afraid that I would die before I never got back to write about that girl. I never stopped yearning to write about her. So, and I think that idea of going back to rediscover how you feel about something when you don't have the tools at the time or you don't have the experience at the time, it's really poignant to read it from that angle, I think.
Yeah, because she had written a book called The Years, which is a memoir that starts in the Second World War and goes right through to the year 2000. So had she glossed over the 1958 part in that, or did it only get a little passing mention, or do you know?
It's a much more expansive book, in that it's actually more about, I think, politics and society, that book, in a lot of ways. I mean, she's talking about De Gaulle, she's talking about France and French politics and etiquette and the way of living. But what I think is that sounds like a massive book when I say the end of the Second World War to 2000. All of her books are very short. She's an absolute master of distillation. She can say an awful lot. And she also has this style, which is often paragraphs and fragmentary ways of jumping around, which allows her to hop around and back and forth in time. So I think this is someone, to me, she's 80 this year and was longlisted last year for the International Man Booker. And her curiosity has never dimmed. She's constantly asking questions. And she talks about, you know, the only reason to write is to find out the meanings. And the multiplicities of writing help us. By writing, you find out the answers to things. And I think a lot of people write for that reason, whether they write fiction or nonfiction. And I think you can feel that coming off the page, that sense of wonder and always being curious about what is desire, what makes us happy, why did someone love us and somebody didn't. And I find that's one of the kind of great joys and strengths of the book.
Yeah, and I know that you would say, if you were going to start have your first dip into Ernaux's writings, that The Years would be the place to start. But let me go back to the one we're speaking about specifically tonight, which is A Girl's Story. Yeah. Does she talk about the whole idea of, you know, memory? Can the memoirist trust her own memories at all? Does she talk about the unreliability or otherwise of memory in A Girl's Story?
I it's funny that a lot of writers, when they're dealing with the past, do, you know, very confrontationally address the idea of memory, but she doesn't exactly. But what she does do is that she says that, and I think a lot of us will find this, for some people it's music, or maybe it's smell, it's an olfactory thing. She says when she finds, she's talking about the tube of toothpaste, the one that she writes the word horror with, she says that memory is a lunatic props mistress, which I thought was quite brilliant, the idea that you'd find something like a hat or a shoe and it will bring you back to a place. But I think she's probably aware that the idea that you have to trust your own instincts and memory as a nonfiction writer, and that you have to believe that the version that you have of it is also the version that you want to tell. And she does say later in the book that she isn't interested in embellishing, and she isn't interested in making things up, because that's not what the point of her work is. It isn't. If it was embellishment and making things up, she'd be a fiction writer. And that's a really important distinction.
Yeah, I said at the beginning that it's probably only in recent times that her writing has come to the type of attention in the English-speaking world that it gets at home in France. Why does she matter, Annie Ernaux, as a writer? What's important about her? Is there something new in what she's doing?
I think probably there are writers who are writing now who would have read Ernaux, or if they haven't, owe a debt to her. And that's probably a lot of American writers. They include Maggie Nelson, that Hilton Alves, Wayne Kostenbaum, Harry Dodge, people like this who've been interested in writing fragments, and the idea that you can write about the self in a very askance and off-kilter kind of way. It doesn't have to be very linear and straightforward, and that you can bring in loads of other subjects in writing about your own life. And I think she mentions in the book being in the Barbican in 1989 in London. So people must have been reading her then and regarding her work. It's just that, again, the ongoing issue with translation, it can take a long time. The work is often done by small presses that wouldn't get the kind of mainstream coverage of, say, the big five publishers. But I think in this way, lots of people I know seem to be reading her and talking about her. And the work seems to me, you know, as fresh as it was when she was, you know, writing the first novel in 1974.
A Girl's Story, are you recommending it, first of all? But I think you will also tell us that we could read the years first. And given that you said they're both short books, maybe we could read both of them.
It's funny, the years happening and this book remind me a lot of Deborah Levy's trilogy. She's working on the third book now, which she calls her work Living Autobiographies. Again, a different take on the idea of writing about the self in memoir. And I do love that. One thing about the guy I wanted to mention, H, in the book, who treats her so badly. And she says later on in the book when she's thinking about him, she says, "I do not envy him because I am the one who is writing," which I love.
So should we read the years first and then A Girl's Story?
I'd say read the three of them. I'd say read Happening as well.
Happening,
but I think that
well.
The years is probably broader base and a bigger grounding. And again, she sort of sometimes makes the space around her a little smaller with some of these books. Some people would say, I don't agree. I think they're very expansive, global and broad. But the years is probably the best known one because of the man Booker. But I think this is a really important and significant book that a lot of people relate to different parts of.
All right, that's Sinead Gleeson there speaking to us about Annie Ernaux, and specifically the most recent publication, which is A Girl's Story. It's published by Fitzcarraldo Editions. Are you flourishing creatively in isolation, or are you at a loose end? Frank McGuinness was speaking to us earlier about how the Abbey Commission was the very thing that spurred him on to sit down at the blank page. Well, here's a closing date coming up that might help you do just the same thing. The RT Short Story Competition in honour of Francis McManus, Friday the 8th of May, which is just over 3 weeks away. That is the deadline for putting in your entry for that particular competition. And you now have the option of entering online as well as by post. The judges who are eagerly awaiting your stories include author Danielle McLaughlin, who joins me now. Start with you, first of all, Danielle. The Wyndham Campbell Prize, the Sunday Times Audible Short Story Award. You've published a book of stories, Dinosaurs on Other Planets, which we spoke about in this programme, if I remember correctly. You have a novel in the pipeline, and in fact, you've been published everywhere, from The Stinging Fly to The New Yorker magazine and beyond. And it's barely 10 years since you started writing fiction. What happened? Because your life literally turned on a sixpence that set you off into writing.
Did about 10 years ago now, I was working as a solicitor, and very suddenly I became very ill. And within a matter of weeks, I had to transfer all my clients to another firm, and I had to stop working. And I found myself suddenly at home and very ill. And I was 40 years old, and I had never had a word of fiction published at that stage. But I started writing short stories, and I haven't gone back to the legal practice since. So my life very much switched tracks.
Had writing always been bubbling away in the background?
I think change can set things in motion.
An article that you wrote in on the RTE Culture page, you quote Mary Lavin, where she says an absolute change of continent could awaken one's awareness. Well, that's what we've had right now in many ways, haven't we? Our world has been turned upside down. This could be the right moment for somebody who's been thinking about it to sit down and do some writing.
I think it could be. I think change can set many things in motion, and the world around us these days is very much changed socially, emotionally, economically. And I think we're starting to look at things in a different way, and we're starting to question things that we maybe took for granted before, and we're seeing things differently. And that, I think, is a very good position to start writing, because there are so many stories to be found if we interrogate the everyday.
I think a couple of minutes ago, too, you were going to tell me about, while you may not have had a word of fiction published, reading was a vital important part of your life before sitting down to do the writing.
Yes, I always loved books. And, you know, over the years when I was younger, there were times when I would have attempted to write stories, but it never worked out for me then. And I think one of the breakthroughs for me was when I realised that stories take a lot of drafts. So when I realised that it's about not just writing a story, but rewriting that story many times, that was something that really helped me. So I would say to somebody who's maybe thinking about writing a short story for the RTE short story competition, maybe have a think about stories that they wrote before and put aside, didn't send out anywhere, stories that they maybe thought had failed. And I would say those aren't failures, those are just drafts. So going back to a story that you left aside some time ago, you could find that you now know the ending that you were missing before.
I would say
maybe collide different stories.
Okay. Among your early successes, Danielle, was being shortlisted, in fact, for this competition we're speaking about this evening, the RTE Short Story Competition in honour of Frances McManus. Do you remember that, the specifics of that time?
Oh, it was absolutely fantastic. I can still remember the absolute thrill of getting the phone calls. And I was fortunate enough to be shortlisted in 2012 and in 2013. And it's just absolutely wonderful, because there's the story that I wrote, you know, by myself in almost a bubble at home at the table, or scribbled away in a cafe, and then it goes out to thousands of listeners.
Yes,
and
because one
the
of the
stories, the 10 shortlisted. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, one of the aspects of this story is that there will be a reading by a professional actor of the shortlisted stories, and that's possibly something that you were talking about, this idea that somebody having a short story that needs to be looked at again, maybe even taking it out and thinking of it in those terms, that you're writing for something that's going to be spoken out loud. Would that help a redrafting?
I think it would. I think I would suggest to people that they read their story aloud to get a sense of what it might sound like on air. And I would also suggest to people that if they have somebody that they trust that they can share their work with in advance of sending it into the competition, that can be really useful, getting feedback on what is working and what isn't working.
You're a great believer in the workshop. You're a great believer in the workshop.
Yes, I am. I've been lucky enough to be in writers' group since, 2011. I've been in the same writers' group, and it has made a huge difference to my work to have that feedback from people who I trust to give me honest and at the same time kind feedback as to what's working.
So for somebody then who might be thinking about, you know, they have something on the backbite, or even something that's been mulling around in their head for quite a while. Now, it's quite a short deadline, if you think about it, 3 weeks' time. What advice would you have for them today?
OK, well, different writers have different processes, and my writing process is quite slow. So it usually takes me a few months to write a story. But I would say that some people complete stories a lot faster. So it is entirely possible that someone would start a story now and have it completed in time for the deadline. But I would also say take out pieces of writing that you've done before. See what can be harvested. Maybe you have bits in one story that you can take and put into another story. So maybe revisit work and do some redrafting. I would also say maybe go through the story and see where you have opportunities of moving from the general to the specific, because it's in the specifics of things that the magic is to be found. I think that's where the writing gold is, and generality can lead us into cliche. So that's one thing I would suggest. Go through your story and see if you can find opportunities to go deeper into the specific.
What about the current situation for you, Danielle, given the lockdown that we're all experiencing? Some writers are finding it difficult, I think, to actually sit down and have a writing routine. How is it working for you?
Well, it's quite different in practical way, I suppose, in that usually would just be me working at home by myself. And now there are five people working from the house. So we're sharing computers and space. So there's that. So it's a very different routine. I find that my creativity is quite sluggish, but at the same time, I take myself to the page every day because I'm finding great comfort in the writing process. And that does bring a bit of routine to my day. So it's not that I'm producing much, but I'm not going to beat myself up over that either. I think the process of writing is helping me at the moment.
But we have a novel on the way, a first novel. When might we see that?
That is due to be published next year. It's called The Art of Falling.
And it's done and finished.
It is. It's finished. Yes, I've started into another novel, but that's at the very early stages yet.
Well, the best of luck with all of that. That's Danielle McLaughlin there speaking to me about the RTE Short Story Competition, which she'll be judging, along with Madeleine Keane and Vincent Woods. The closing date is Friday the 8th of May. Top prize there of €3,000, and all 10 shortlisted stories will be broadcast on RTE Radio 1 in the autumn. You can get all of the details on how to enter on rte.ie/writing. There we go, a track called Early from Joy Crooks, and that was a single she released in 2019 with the Dublin rapper and singer Jafaris. Joy Crooks was born in South London, but she has Irish and Bangladeshi roots. Her mother from Bangladesh, her father from North Dublin. And we will be speaking to Joy Crooks on Friday night's Arena. Sergio Vieira de Mello was a Brazilian diplomat who was High Commissioner for Human Rights during the Iraq War. A new film, simply called Sergio, is being released on Netflix, starring Wagner Moura, best known for his role as Pablo Escobar in Narcos. He's playing the title role of Sergio in this film. Etna Shorthall has been looking at the film for us, and she joins me on the line now. How good a subject is de Mello for a film of this nature, would you say, Etna?
Well, I would start by saying that I had never heard of him before, so I don't know how well known he would be amongst the general public. Is there enough interest in him for people to want to watch a film about him? I don't know. And also, the other thing is that it's a biopic, but it's not his entire life. It's only looking at the kind of more recent events, and so we don't deal at all with his childhood or adolescence. So within that, then, the interest is the work that he did, for me anyway, the work he did within the UN. That was interesting. So he was, at the time that the film focuses, he was the UN's High Commissioner for Human Rights. He was at the time expected to take over from Kofi Annan. And he had done some really big missions at the UN. Notably, he had overseen East Timor becoming an independent nation, getting its independence from Indonesia. So that is fascinating. However, the film chooses to make the focus his relationship with another UN worker, Carolina. And that feels a little more bizarre and less interesting, because the relationship, they try their very best to make it a very interesting, fascinating relationship, and they go for a lot of melodrama. We've got like steamy sex scenes and kissing in the rain, but it's just never as interesting as his career. But the career just doesn't get as much on camera time.
Yeah, the particular, the Carolina Larrera was the Argentinian economic advisor to the transitional government in East Timor. So she was a vital cog in that particular
solution that he found there.
Mm. Yeah, that's where they met. But let's talk then about the specifics of some of the political situations. And I'll start with a clip, in fact, from his time in Iraq. He's just given a speech where he's stressing the independence of the United Nations as an organization, and straight away he gets a call from a US diplomat, Paul Bremer, played by Bradley Whitford, and Bremer is the leader of the coalition's provisional authority.
Paul, what can I do for you?
Sergio, that was quite a performance you had there.
No tool, no cover for anyone not here supporting the occupation?
I honestly believe this serves both our interests,
Paul. If Iraqis know the UN is independent,
then the elections we supervise will be seen as legitimate. And if the elections are legitimate, Paul, then we can all go home.
I've decided there won't be any elections.
Not until we're ready.
Yes, I also decided something
I needed to share with you.
Tomorrow morning, we'll send the Security Council a full dossier concerning the occupation and its many human rights violations, Paul.
You know, hang on, pull over. Pull over, give me 1 second.
Paul.
A dossier to the Security Council? You can't do that, Sergio.
With all due respect, Paul, you have no authority to tell me what I can or cannot do.
The Security Council mandate is very clear. You're here to
support our effort to stabilize and rebuild Iraq. That's the only reason you're here.
The only reason I'm here is because you broke it.
And you have no idea how to put it back together again.
Sergio,
you're an ambitious guy.
Attacking the U.S. isn't the best way to become the next Secretary General, I can tell you that.
Goodbye, Paul.
There we had Mauro, his name's gone straight out of my head, Wagner Mauro, as Sergio Vieira de Mello in the new Netflix film Sergio. And also in that clip was Bradley Whitford playing the US diplomat Paul Bremer. Etna Shorthill has been looking at the film for us, and she's talking to me this evening. You get a real sense of the kind of political power play that was at stake there. And those scenes in both in the Iraq situation and in the East Timor situation, and in another point when he finds himself in the jungle in Cambodia, that's where the film really works for me anyway, Etna.
Absolutely, and I found that fascinating. That is definitely the high points of the film, and possibly that's because the director, Greg Barker, his background is in documentaries, and particularly in political documentaries. He made a film about the capturing of bin Laden. He made a film more recently about Obama. And he actually made a documentary about Sergio in 2009. And much of the same ground is covered here. So that very nice insights into the UN's uneasy relationship with the US and the work that the UN does. We see that the Americans are planning to rebuild Abu Ghraib, where Saddam Hussein had tortured so many people, and Sergio saying, well, this is bad optics, but the Americans don't care. As far as they're concerned, the UN works for them, and that actually is said at one point in the film. And actually, we know near the beginning, the film begins with an explosion at the UN's headquarters in Baghdad. And so Sergio is lying under rubble and he's thinking back over these recent events in his life. But just before the explosion, he had made a decision to go public with the US's human rights violations in Iraq. And he has the report ready to go, and he's called a press conference. And then there's this massive explosion.
Interesting that you give us Greg Barker, the director's documentary background there, because I was struck by the number of times that real footage was used of President George W. Bush, or indeed of Kofi Annan, who was the UN Secretary General, as you said, at the time. He seemed to be able to knit those, the acted bits and the real footage, he knitted those together very well, Barker.
Yeah, and it's the film is bookended with Sergio giving, he's kind of speaking to the camera, welcoming new employees of the UN. And it's done by the actor, Wagner Moura, but then at the end we see a transition into the real Sergio. And you realise that it's quite good casting in terms of appearance, at least.
Right, okay, but we do have to talk about the love story. So let's have a listen to a clip. It's Ana de Armas is the actor who plays the part of Carolina Larrera, and they're in East Timor at this point. He's still married, deeply in love with Carolina, and he's been asked by the UN to go to Iraq, but he also wants to return to Brazil, his home. And here he has a final special evening with Carolina.
I want to go back home. I want to go back to Brazil. To Apodo. I want to stop being what people expect me to be. It seems easy, but it's not an easy thing for me to do.
Should go and do that.
Wait. Look at me. I want to see this country independent and free. And I want you. I really want you.
There we go. Ana de Armas as Carolina and Wagner Moura as Sergio in that clip from the film, Sergio. Does the love story work, or did the love story work for you, Etna?
I mean, no, not in what's asked of it. Like I said, it just seems like a bizarre decision to have someone with this career and to focus on the love story. And like, whilst it's a very interesting organisation that they're working in, it's effectively an office romance. And I just didn't think it could compare to the work that he'd done. And it, for me, it's the reason that the film often feels like a made-for-TV movie. Whilst this relationship is happening, Sergio is still married, and his wife is in Switzerland with their two children. And whilst the issue of him being a kind of absentee father, not a great dad, is addressed, the fact that he's still married and presumably estranged, but who knows, that's never really addressed. No. And that is a problem with the film. You have to assume that the director, Greg Barker, is one of the many admirers of Sergio, and as you would be given the work that he's done. But, you know, Barker made a documentary, then he decided to make a feature film, and I really don't feel like he questions Sergio's weaker sides, and at times that can render him two-dimensional. You know, like a lot of the publicity material around this describes him as charismatic, and you really feel like that's the one word that that Moura went with playing the part, but that the scriptwriter took on board, the director. You know, he's almost James Bond-esque at times. He's just so irresistibly suave and handsome and perfect.
Your final mention to Brian F. O'Byrne, the Irish actor, who plays a fellow diplomat, Gil Loescher, who's a kind of a composite character, I think, of a number of de Mello's actual colleagues. How does Brian F. O'Byrne fare for you?
Yeah, I thought he was great. And he's kind of the sensible foil, or the straight-laced foil, as it were, to Sergio. He goes where he goes. And, you know, as Sergio is impulsive and charismatic, Gil, you know, carries the files and tells him, be careful and don't do that. And yeah, I thought he was one of the standout performances. For me, a lot of the strongest performances were amongst the supporting characters.
All right, that's Etna Shorthall speaking to us about the film Sergio. It will be released on Netflix, streaming from this Friday. Before we finish up this evening, a moment of beauty to take us over the midweek hump from poet and writer John O'Donnell.
When? And when this ends, we will emerge, shyly, and then all at once, dazed, long-haired, as we embrace loved ones the shadow spared, and weep for those it gathered in its shroud. A kind of rapture, this longed-for laying on of hands, high cries as we nuzzle, leaning in to kiss and whisper that now things will be different, although a time will come when we'll forget the curve's approaching wave, the hiss and sigh of ventilators, the crowded makeshift morgues, a time when we may even miss the old world arm's-length courtesy, small kindnesses left on doorsteps, the drifting idle days, and nights when we flung open all the windows to arias in the darkness, our voices reaching out, holding each other till this passes.
John O'Donnell there with his poem When, and John's collection of short stories Almost the Same Blue will be published by Dura Press next month. And that is our lot for this evening on Arena. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Dave Gibson was on sound this evening. Tonight's programme produced by Sinead Egan. Talk to you tomorrow night at 7.